Chapter 5. African in America. This chapter traces the process by which Barack Obama became black. We know that Obama wants to be known as African American. He said so himself by checking the box on the 2010 U.S. Census form marked Black, African American, or Negro. How then did Obama become black? Surely not by appearance. The man is lighter skinned than I am, and I'm not black. Nor did Obama become black through skin treatments, whether discovered through imaginary issues of Life magazine or elsewhere. Writing in the Washington Post, Maria Rana informs us that Obama is not our first black president. He's our first biracial, bicultural president. The same point was made by political maverick Christopher Hitchens on the BBC program Newsnight. In an Associated Press article, many insisting that Obama is not black, the position articulated by Arana and Hitchens is rebutted by an appeal to the one-drop rule. This is the infamous rule according to which a single drop of black blood makes a person officially black. But the one-drop rule is an American phenomenon that doesn't really apply to Obama. On the liberal website Salon, Deborah Dickerson noted that black in our political and social vocabulary means those descended from West African slaves. That's not Obama, as African-American columnist Stanley Crouch points out. Obama's mother is of white U.S. stock. His father is a black Kenyan. Crouch's article was titled, What Obama Isn't, Black Like Me. In American history, the one-drop rule traces back not to slavery, but to segregation. It was a way for Southerners to enforce segregation laws and prevent mixed-race persons from passing as white. In the antebellum period, slave status passed through the mother and had nothing to do with whether one looked light or dark. But of course, Obama has no roots in American slavery, and neither did he grow up in the South. His childhood experience, as we have seen, is scarcely comparable to that of most blacks in the United States. So we're back to the question of how Obama became black. Certainly, Obama recognized from early adolescence on that he needed to be black. There were psychological reasons for this. Obama knew that he was different, and during his teens and early 20s, blackness was a way to understand and express that difference. The choice of blackness made sense because he wanted to identify with his African father. His father wasn't around, however, and the surrogates whom he found happened to be black Americans. Another reason is political. As a young man who aspired to politics, Obama knew that he would have to count on a group that he could call his own, one that he could rally and that would rally behind him. Kenyans in America is not a large constituency, so Obama wisely chose African Americans as his home team. Obama's strategy for becoming black was both simple and ingenious. Through laborious effort, he familiarized himself with the literature and rhetoric of the black American experience. And then he found a way to fit that black experience into the anti-colonial experience. In other words, he came to see the situation facing African Americans as analogous to the one facing Native peoples around the world in their struggles with Western domination. Here is a sample of how Obama routinely makes the connection. I know, I have seen the desperation and disorder of the powerless, how it twists the lives of children on the streets of Jakarta or Nairobi in much the same way as it does the lives of children on Chicago's South Side. I know that the response of the powerful to this disorder is inadequate to the task. In this way, the son of a Kenyan immigrant and a white woman from Kansas is successfully able to pass as a black American. We know the strategy has worked because Obama has always gotten away with it, and it helped to carry him to the White House. When Obama worked as a community activist in Chicago, his boss gave him a copy of Taylor Branch's Parting the Waters, a history of Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. Obama said, "This is my story." In reality, this wasn't his story, but he made it his story. When Obama spoke during the presidential campaign in the church in Selma, he shared the stage with his Democratic rival Hillary Clinton. She was married to the man whom novelist Toni Morrison dubbed the first black president. Obama had to beat out Hillary and claim that title for himself, winning the endorsement of John Lewis, Joseph Lowery, and the other civil rights leaders in the audience. And he did. They embraced him as one of them. Historically, Obama's strategy of passing into blackness via a third world route is not such a strange move. Many black leaders have attempted to draw parallels between the American black experience and that of the peoples of Africa and the third world. In 1957, Martin Luther King was invited to Ghana to witness the transfer of power from the British to the new president, Kwame Nkrumah. The transfer took place on midnight of March 5th, and King was deeply moved by it. King saw that Nkrumah didn't come dressed as a ruler or prince, but rather wearing the prison cap assigned to him when he was jailed by his colonialist captors. "Before I knew it," King said, "I started weeping. I was crying for joy." In a private reception with Nkrumah, King said, "I want you to come to visit us down in Alabama, where we are seeking the same kind of freedom Ghana is celebrating." King subsequently said, "There's no basic difference between colonialism and racial segregation, and this event, the birth of this new nation, will give impetus to oppressed peoples all over the world, not only in Asia and Africa, but also in America." King preached a sermon on that topic the following month at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. He rallied American blacks to resistance, saying that oppressors never give in without a fight. Then he promised that victory would come for blacks in America as it had come for the subject people of Ghana. "An old order of colonialism, of segregation, of discrimination is passing away, and a new order of justice is being born." In the mid-1960s, Malcolm X traveled to Africa, where he visited more than a dozen countries, including Egypt, Sudan, Ethiopia, Kenya, Tanzania, Nigeria, Ghana, Liberia, and Algeria. He had meetings with several of the new rulers of Africa, including Kenyatta in Kenya, Nkrumah in Ghana, Milton Obote in Uganda, and Julius Nyerere of Tanzania. "You can't separate the African Revolution from the mood of the black man in America," Malcolm X said in a subsequent interview with two leaders of America's Young Socialist Alliance. "You can't separate the militancy that's displayed on the African continent from the militancy that's displayed right here among American blacks. Since Africa has gotten its independence through revolution, you'll notice the stepped-up cry against discrimination in the black community." And in 1971, Jesse Jackson drew the same connection in a typically Jesse Jackson way. Upon hearing that the United Nations was providing funds for poor, developing countries, Jackson submitted a request that the United Nations fund Black America through his own group, Operation Push. Jackson's appeal was based on the idea that blacks in America constituted a kind of poor developing nation within the United States, and since he was the spokesman for Black America, he was a deserving recipient of UN money. The UN declined to provide any funds, but hey, you can't blame Jackson for trying. While these civil rights leaders all drew the parallel between anti-colonialism and the American black struggle, they were basically trying to fit the anti-colonial model into the civil rights model. In effect, they were saying, "What matters most to us is our struggle in America, and now let's show how our struggle over here is really part of this bigger struggle that's going on around the world." Obama makes the same transition, but in the opposite direction. He figures out how to fit the civil rights model into the anti-colonial model. In effect, Obama is saying, "What matters most to me is this big struggle between the rulers and the subject peoples across the globe, but I can understand and identify with the black struggle in America as a local skirmish within that larger conflict." Even before he went to the Punahou School in Hawaii, Obama was introduced to the black American experience by his mother. She brought home audio recordings of Martin Luther King speeches and the music of Mahalia Jackson. At school, Obama remembers reading James Baldwin, Ralph Ellison, Richard Wright, Langston Hughes, and W.E.B. Du Bois. He was especially impressed with Malcolm X and probably got from him what he calls his badass nigger pose. And it was a pose. With fine self-perception, Obama writes of putting on a racial costume and living out a caricature of black male adolescence. He even tries to attribute his drug use to his rebel stance, although drugs were easily available in Hawaii and socially cool to try at Punahou. And perhaps no further explanation is needed than that. Obama's racial posturing reached its zenith the day his grandmother, Madeline Dunham, came home and asked that her husband drive her to work the following week. She complained that an aggressive bum had hassled her at the bus stop. "I gave him a dollar and he kept asking." Weirdly, Obama's grandfather accused his wife of only wanting him to drive her because the bum was black. "And I just don't think that's right," he declared pompously. Now, one might expect the grandson to at least attempt to defend his grandmother, who was working in large part to pay for his schooling. His grandfather was barely working at the time, so it was hardly an imposition for him to make the drive. Instead, Obama responded thus to his grandfather's accusation. "The words were like a fist in my stomach, and I wobbled to regain my composure. I knew that men who might easily have been my brothers could still inspire their rawest fears." But of course, Obama's reaction depends entirely on the pretense that aggressive bums are no cause for female alarm. Most likely, Madeline's fears would not have been provoked had she been joined at the bus stop by a black man in a suit. Her anxiety, in other words, was not the product of baseless prejudice, but rather a reasonable conclusion based on the facts of the situation. Even so, her grandson treats her like a kind of closet bigot. This shameful episode is partly excused by Obama's youth, although, as we will see, Obama brought it up again in his mature years. On that occasion, he much more inexcusably exploited it to obtain political cover for himself. Obama discussed his grandmother's alleged fear of blacks with one of his grandfather's buddies, a black radical and secret member of the Communist Party named Frank Marshall Davis. During the presidential campaign, some conservatives highlighted Davis's communist ties. This provoked John Edgar Tidwell, who has edited a volume of Davis's writings, to protest what he termed the McCarthy-era smear tactics against Davis. Tidwell's protests are in vain. In the book's introduction, he himself admits that Davis was in fact a communist for at least part of his career. Still, we will discover that this was not the most important thing about Davis as far as Obama was concerned. Davis, like Stanley Dunham, was from Kansas, and since Davis had a white wife, Stanley evidently thought he qualified as an excellent multiracial role model for his grandson. Grandfather would take Obama to Davis's cottage, where Obama would sit on the ground and watch the two men smoke, drink, play Scrabble, and talk. While discussing Grandma's racism, however, Davis spoke to Obama only in Stanley's absence. Davis told Obama that no white person could understand blacks. "Maybe some of these Hawaiians can, or the Indians on the reservation. They've seen their fathers humiliated, their mothers desecrated. But your grandfather will never know what that feels like." Therefore, Davis concluded, "Your grandma's right to be scared. She understands that black people have a reason to hate." Once again, Obama responds in dramatic fashion. "The earth shook under my feet, ready to crack open at any moment. I stopped, trying to steady myself, and knew for the first time that I was utterly alone." Davis is important because he ameliorated that loneliness and became a kind of surrogate father for Obama, at least while he stayed in Hawaii. Recall that Obama did not at this time live with either of his natural parents. Even later, Obama remembered Davis fondly, and when he quit his job as a financial researcher to become a community organizer, Obama wrote, "It made me smile, thinking back on Frank and his old black power dashiki self." Hawaiians who remember Davis say the man was just as likely to sport cutoffs and aloha shirts. More important, Davis's biographer points out that his editorial philosophy connected white supremacy and Imperialism. A recent book, The Writings of Frank Marshall Davis, clearly demonstrates the centrality of anti-colonialism to the man's writings. Davis's early work is focused on black power. He grew so frustrated with what he perceived to be the inherent bigotry of American life that when he saw the black actor and activist Paul Robeson praising Hawaii as a multiracial paradise, he packed up and moved there. In Hawaii, Davis was impressed by the absence of anti-black sentiment. In his column, Land of Ethnic Hash, Davis writes, "You soon learn that in Hawaii you can't tell an individual's ethnic origin by looking. There were prejudices, but these are much more complex than those on the mainland. Out here, many dark Puerto Ricans are insulted if they are mistaken for Japanese. The Portuguese bitterly resent being called haole or mainland white. Many Koreans will let you know right away that they are not Chinese." So Davis's philosophy became less black-centered, in fact, less racial, and began to incorporate what he saw as wider currents of oppression and subjugation. I was particularly struck by Davis's three-part series examining the fate of the world in the aftermath of World War II. Davis asked, "Would an international institution like the United Nations insist that all the major countries, including Russia and China, have an equal say, or would Britain and America dominate the post-war economic and political order?" Davis focused his critical lens on a single man, Winston Churchill, whom Davis accused of seeking Anglo-American supremacy. Davis argued that since Britain was no longer powerful enough to hold its empire on its own, Churchill was pushing for America to join Britain in sustaining and indeed extending the old British Empire. In Davis's view, Churchill had a plan to use strong-arm tactics to bludgeon all other countries into submission, and thus Britain and America could establish their joint sway over the whole world. Davis termed this prospect super-imperialism. Obama makes no reference to any of Davis's writings, and merely calls him a poet named Frank. But given Davis's worldview, it is easy to see his appeal to young Obama. And given Davis's antipathy for Churchill, a man whose colonial history Davis knew well, we can see where Obama learned this other side of the scourge of the Nazis. Perhaps we have a source here for why Obama removed that Churchill bust from the White House. But Davis wasn't finished with Obama in Hawaii. Before Obama left home in 1979 to enroll at Occidental College in Los Angeles, Davis warned him about leaving your race at the door, leaving your people behind. "Obama should beware of the establishment," Davis said, "because they'll train you so good you'll start believing what they tell you about equal opportunity and the American way and all that shit." Davis counseled Obama to be on his guard and stay awake.